Wednesday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. Break day during the NBA Finals, but we still have a big show for you. First off, the offseason cap preview for the Houston Rockets, who have a really interesting offseason. And we talk about what some of the options are. They could have over $40 million in cap space if they move some things around, maybe even enough for two max slots. So we'll talk about what they might be able to do. Also, we have a ton of news to get to, including the latest on Andrew Bogut's injury. And then also a scouting report on perhaps the most mysterious, at least to Americans, prospect in this draft, Dragan Bender, a Croatian who played with Maccabi Tel Aviv last year. A stretch four with a 9-3 standing reach and great feel for the game, but also some question marks about his game. So we'll go through him in great detail. But first, a team that does not think that it really should be in this position, perhaps, but they are, having finished 41-41, the eighth-seeded Houston Rockets.
Yeah, the Rockets are one of that group of teams that could potentially really change the dynamics of this offseason if they get their druthers.
Yeah, so it always seemed like Dwight Howard was going to opt out. He has 1 year left on his contract at $23.3 million, but he has a player option on that, on which he has to decide by June 29th. He almost certainly will opt out of that at age 30, hoping to get more guaranteed money. He may actually have to take a step down in starting salary, but at least we'll be able to get a longer-term contract. The odds that he returns to Houston seem to grow smaller by the day now that Mike D'Antoni has been hired there, with whom he did not particularly get along when he was in L.A., whom he left, actually, when he was in L.A., and then also just the reports of tension between he and Harden. He said he's not ruling it out, but I would be very shocked if he wants to come back, or if they even have any interest in paying him what his market rate will be, which will still be probably at least for a couple of years, $20 million a year. So, without him, how do they look?
Well, they still have James Harden, player who finished second and most valuable player last year, though that will presumably be the high watermark for his career, and there's, of course, no shame in that. Then the other guaranteed contracts they have, I'm not going to do full numbers, but the guaranteed contracts are Ariza, Corey Booker, Patrick Beverley, KJ McDaniels, Sam Decker, Clint Capella, and Montrezl Harrell.
Yeah, so with all those guys, and assuming Dwight opts out, no cap hold. They also have Dwight's cap hold will be the maximum, his maximum of $30.3 million. That's another reason I don't expect him to come back, because they are going to want to get that off of their books. And then they also have cap holds for Terrence Jones and Denis Mateunas. Both of those are about $6 million each. Those guys are restricted free agents as rookie contracts coming off of their fourth year of service. So if you take out all those guys who are free agents and their cap holds, and it's possible that none of those people will be back, we'll see about Jones and Mateunas, they would have $43.4 million in space. Now, if they wanted to move on from Corey Brewer, who is making $7.6 million next year, and then has another year after that at $7.5 million, and maybe the only bad contract I can recall that Daryl Morey has handed out in recent times, if they were able to move on from him, either by attaching a younger asset to him or just some team that has space actually thinking he's still good, which he isn't, then they could, and they also could have a non-guarantee of Beasley, which you mentioned, that's a $1.4 million. They could then get up pretty darn close to two max slots. A max slot for 7 to 9 years experience is $26 million. So they would get to $48 million in, no, I'm sorry, they would get to two max slots then if they dump Brewer and Beasley, or pretty darn close to it. And then if they wanted to open up another $3 million, they could move on from KJ McDaniels, and they would still have six players on the roster. And that's actually not too bad for them. They wouldn't be as kind of gutted as a lot of teams, because they do have starters who are not amazing but are decent for very low money alongside Harden.
Yeah, they have. So if you think about that core of the players that were not mentioned, you have Harden, of course, Clint Capella, who could be a starting center or it could be a backup center if that's what you use one of these slots on. Then Trevor Ariza and Patrick Beverley, who I think is a nice little fit for them.
Yeah, you know, I think of Ariza as kind of an average starter this last year. Good defender on the wing. Doesn't do much offensively other than spot up from deep, and he's more of a volume guy. I mean, he hit 40% on threes 1 year in Washington when he had John Wall setting him up, but generally for his career has settled in around a 35% three-point shooter, but you have to guard him out there. And then Beverley doesn't really create much, but his defense is nice, struggles to stay healthy. His defense has kind of waned as he's played more minutes and has gotten into a later phase of his career, going into his late 20s now, but still a capable enough starter. And then Capella, not really proven in a starting role, but certainly a guy who in short minutes has been effective. I'm not sure that I'm saying, hey, our center position is locked down, but if you have some other options, you might say, okay, we're going to go with him as a starter. And then Harden, remember now, you think of him as a max guy, but now because the cap has gone up, he actually is very cheap. He's only making $16 million this year and $17 million next year. So with that being the case, they really have a decent enough core to add to if they wanted to get two max stars. Of course, the issue is everybody has cap space, number one. And number two, there aren't that many max stars out there.
Yeah, and I think that's the big question with this, is I agree with your premise that, you know, if you could get two of that top group, it would be wonderful. However, who in that group is a good fit and who in that group has a realistic chance of coming?
Well, if there have been reports that although Kevin Durant and James Harden have been hanging out together, KD is not going to consider the Rockets. They are still pushing for it. And if I were KD, I would listen, because you have a couple of things here that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but just off the top of my head, there are no other potential suitors that can offer, number one, an existing top 10 player or top 15 player in the league already on the team. And then also the ability to pick another person from this free agent class to join them. And when you consider that, you know, if you could get Mike Conley or you could get Batum or you could get Horford to join Harden and join KD, and then they all would have some reasonable enough depth alongside those guys and, you know, hopefully could fill out with ring-chasing veterans. I don't know. Do you think that team, let's say you could do that. We have no indication that Horford or Conley want to go there, and they could not get the fifth year either. That's probably important to those guys if they do, because they wouldn't be re-signing with their prior team. But if you could get Conley or you could get Horford, pair them with KD and Harden and the guys they have, what do you think of that team?
I think they'd be definitely a capable team. They would be in the mix. I would say they would probably still be, well, depending on how much defense you could get with that other guy, they might still be below the Warriors if they stay healthy, but they're firmly in the mix with everyone else, and you would have just a ton of talent that would be able to generate offense. I mean, because you have Durant and Harden, who, of course, have played together before, but are much better players, in my opinion, now than they were then. Having them together, you can do kind of what I call the stagger plus, which is you separate them so they can each get their time running the show, and then, of course, you still play them together as well. So I think they should definitely get a meeting. Whether it is the best fit depends a lot on what Kevin Durant wants, but they have something to offer that no one else can offer.
I mean, if they could get Horford and KD, and this is obviously probably a pipe dream, but, you know, it's something that Durant should think about, and this is, I'm sure, what Morey would be pitching to both Durant and Horford, and he is certainly not deterred by long odds in these sorts of things. He will work hard to sell guys. I think that's clearly the number two seed, and maybe even the number one seed in the Western Conference, assuming that they can defend. But I think with Horford, KD, Ariza, Beverly, and then you also have D'Antoni, like, you'd probably play KD at the 4-2 a lot. You could start Capella and Horford together, and then you'd probably close with KD at the 4, Ariza at 3. Harden's defense would look a lot better, and he also wouldn't have to have the ball in his hands all the time. He could concentrate on D a little bit more. Beverly, a guy who can hit some spot shots. Like, that's a really good team. That's a 60-win team, I think, pretty clearly. Do you think that team is better than what Oklahoma City is likely to be next year?
I'm a big fan of Steven Adams, but I think that you could definitely make that argument. And the other big case for Houston in that sense is that other than Harden, the guys would all be under team control for a while. You know, it's like the core members of that team, because you'd be getting Horford, presumably he would be on a long-term deal. So you don't have to worry about the other guys stranding you in a city, which is why he's probably going to sign a 1+1 with the Thunder, because that is the other way of mitigating that risk, is just not taking that risk. But you would...
Well, here, and let me jump in right there, too. Part of the other problem is, we know why he wants to sign a 1+1, right? Because he has 9 years of experience. If he goes to 10 next year, then he can re-sign with Oklahoma City for 5 years, starting at, you know, the cap's going up a lot, and he also would be in the 10-year experience. So he's basically starting at $35 million next year as opposed to $25 million this year. And he could do that with another team, but he could only go for 4 years. And that team would have to use cap space to re-sign him again because they would only be able to pay him 120% of what he was making. And I guess so that would, it would be he'd be starting basically at $30 million instead of 35. So he'd be costing himself some money almost certainly by not returning to Oklahoma City. But then again, Westbrook could leave after next year and then you're out in the cold. You would have to just sign somewhere else anyway. And it's also possible that Houston could just have that cap space the year after anyway. But that's just something to consider, this idea that if he goes somewhere else and signs a 1+1, he's probably costing himself pretty significant money. So sorry I interrupted
you. No, that's great. It's a point we've never made on this podcast, but I've wanted to make it before, so I'm happy you did.
Yeah, so where were you going after that?
So basically, I just think that there is a logic to it, and they could go there, but you're going to need that other piece. And as we saw with the Suns getting Tyson Chandler and hoping to get LaMarcus Aldridge, even that part of it can be dicey.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that those two guys would have to just agree together. I don't know that Durant and Horford have much of a relationship other than simply being, you know, knowing each other from the 2007 draft, or Conley, for that matter, who's not as good of a fit. I mean, he would certainly help, but I think you would rather have Horford in this instance, even though Conley's a little younger. Let's say they don't get KD, though. And now, what if you were, I mean, the only other guys that I think really are just like dead bang max guys who could really help them would probably be Batum, Conley, and Horford. And you could pitch those two guys to come in. You probably would have a pretty good team then. Probably not a team that would beat the Warriors, assuming they come back intact. Chandler Parsons is another guy, too, that you could might consider, but I don't think he's going to come back, especially if Dwight leaves. He and Dwight are boys, but Parsons seems like he's pretty much all in on Dallas, and he's also a health risk as well. So that's another issue. I think that, you know, Conley and Horford going there, I mean, that's like better than their incumbent situations. There are some reports indicating that some Grizzlies executives are worried that Conley might leave, but, you know, whatever, take that with a grain of salt. So I don't know. I mean, what do you think of kind of the remaining options there?
I don't particularly love any of them, especially when you consider that almost all of those guys are on the older end, and I would be trying to aim a little bit younger. You know, like as much as Harden is, you know, probably, you know, we said his best year was probably last year. So I still don't think I would necessarily push for those contracts that 3 and 4 years from now could be albatrosses. I think that's a little bit too narrow a window, when even with them, the Rockets wouldn't be the best team in the West. So I can see the logic for it, but it isn't something I support.
Well, I mean, this idea that you can guarantee with any move that you're going to be the best team in the West, especially with what this Warriors team was in the regular season, is difficult. I mean, I think if you're looking at, you know, pretty good as like a top 2-3 seed,
would they be better than the Thunder? I don't think so.
Yeah, it depends. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, we don't know how D'Antoni. I mean, D'Antoni, you assume, is going to get this offense to hum. I don't know about the defense. I mean, I mean, if those guys want to come, I would do it as Houston. Because you also have to consider, too, that Harden himself can be a free agent in 2 years, and they're going to need to be decent to keep him. But that's one plan. I mean, I think, you know, if those guys would come, bird in the hand is better than, you know, two in the bush, or two in hand would be better than three in the bush in 2017 or whatever it is. But let's say you can't get both of those guys to come. You're going to kind of just sit on your $43 million in cap space. That's down to about 32 if you retain the cap holds of Terrence Jones and Donatus Mata-Unis. And I think in that case, you're going to say, all right, what can we do to just get a little bit better here and maybe not lock into too many long contracts? We'll still have Harden, and we can just kind of get better this year, but also play kind of the same open up two max slots in 2017 game, which they can get pretty close to doing. They would have about $57 million in 2017 space to try this exact same thing with maybe, you know, a little bit better of a market. So the two things I think they need to improve the most are defense and passing / playmaking.
Yeah, that's certainly fair. And as a general positional need, I would also add in, just if they're depending on what they do with the restricted guys, a power forward that makes sense within the D'Antoni offense. And one of the big challenges, we've talked about this with a few teams, but I think the Rockets plan, kind of plan B, if you want to call it that, is a great illustration of this, is how hard it is going to be to get a player that is worthwhile to agree to a contract that keeps your powder dry.
Yeah, keeping that flexibility is going to be difficult. You'd have to really, really overpay. I think the sort of guy they might want to go to, they've always really wanted a stretch four. D'Antoni is going to make that even more of a priority. Marvin Williams, Luol Deng, those type of guys, just throw as much money as you can at them for a year would be something that they might consider doing. I don't really see Hassan Whiteside as that good of a fit for them, and obviously there'll be plenty of competition for his services. Maybe what they could do too at center is, if they really believe in Capella, they can just retain Tanas Mataunas, unless he just gets some unbelievably ridiculous offer sheet in free agency, which I don't necessarily expect him to with his back issues. But, you know, if you just keep him as a combo big, he could play a little four alongside Capella. He could play some backup center for you. I feel like you're pretty good, at center there, and just try to fill in with some more wings. What would you think of Evan Turner on this team? I think actually as a guy, he's sort of in the same role with the Celtics, play a little with the starters, but be a guy who can create a little bit of something at least on the second unit when Harden's out of the game.
If they see Beverly and Harden as guys who should play together, and I completely see the logic there because it mitigates a lot of Beverly's biggest weakness, then you need a lot of that on the second unit. And considering how horrendous the point guard market is, getting that creation in a non-point guard in Evan Turner would be a logical fit. I don't love him playing with Harden, but he could be worth serious money for them if they have aspirations, even if he's playing primarily backup minutes.
Yeah, you can help out the defense. I mean, he's no worse for your spacing than Corey Brewer. He's probably a little bit better for that. At least he can make a mid-ranger, and he didn't shoot that well on threes last year, but I think he at least shot okay the year before that, and especially from the corner. So, and he's at least a threat to do something once he catches the ball, with Brewer was not really anymore. I think that Joe Johnson is actually someone on a one-year deal that could help them just to provide a little bit more scoring, spacing, play a little stretch four. The defense would be pretty ugly with him as a stretch four. Even Jamal Crawford is someone I might look at as like a microwave type off the bench that they could really use, although he and Harden playing together would probably be a pretty big disaster. And then, of course, our old friend Jared Dudley, who would fit in, I think, basically just about anywhere, and didn't play, I think, specifically for D'Antoni in Phoenix, but has played in that style of offense before as a small ball four, and I think could be an excellent fit there just with his intelligence. They need more smart guys who move the ball and can pass.
And one of the most fascinating questions with this Rockets team is if they can get anything from their young guys, basically, that haven't really played much, because if they can get at least one rotation player out of KJ McDaniels, Montrezl Harrell, and Sam Decker, that would be a major boon for them, because they all play roles of need for this team if they kind of clear their free agent decks.
Yeah, so I don't really see anyone out there who's going to improve the defense a lot on this team. You know, they're 8th in offense, 20th in defense. Last year, maybe you could say Deng, but he might be too many years for them if they want to try to maintain flexibility. I know they see themselves as a free agent destination. D'Antoni seems like a guy who's probably going to improve the offense, but maybe your hope is you can just get enough decent role players who can shoot. This team will be more than the sum of its parts. You get back into the mix for kind of, you know, the 5th seed, the 4th seed. Next year, maybe the Clippers take a step back and you can get home court advantage and win a round in the playoffs, and then make yourself attractive to the 2017 free agent class once again.
Yeah, and the 2017 class, beyond being top heavy, it does have some guys that would be particularly interesting fits with James Harden in particular, and the guy that I'm thinking of is George Hill.
Yeah, George Hill could be good, although he's going to be 31 at that point, and he replicates in some ways what Beverly does, although Hill is probably a more versatile defender and a little bit better of a shooter and playmaker. They might want to say try for KD again, although that would eat into a lot of that $57 million if they got to pay him $35. Blake Griffin could be a free agent. I could see them looking at him. Paul Millsap, Serge Ibaka, Gordon Hayward, all those guys, I think, would be possibilities for Houston in 2017. But again, there's going to be a ton of teams with space, and you have no idea what it's going to look like then, whether they can be a destination for any of those guys. But they do like to maintain their flexibility.
Yeah, and maintaining flexibility is also what I think is going to keep them out of the center market, as much as I think that would be an interesting use of their space, as much as they like Capella, just because there is actually a decent supply of them, just because they're all going to want years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Capella, this is the year that you got to kind of find out if he can be a starter. He's going to be extension eligible next year. And, you know, I'm not sure. I really am not. I mean, I what I would like if I were them is have another option who could be like a combo big, or another center who could play in play Capella 20, 25 minutes a game and not have to be really relying on him to be a great defensive player. You know, that's what he has not really shown a ton of defensive intelligence so far in his career. And I'm not sure that D'Antoni is necessarily the guy to teach it to him. But, you know, I mean, if they feel like, all right, we need some more insurance on the center market, Timofey Mozgov type of guy could be someone that they would look at.
Zaza Pachulia.
Yeah, Zaza Pachulia could be another one, although he doesn't really strike me as a D'Antoni type of guy. Mo Spates as a guy off the bench, stretch five, I think could be pretty good in D'Antoni's system. And another guy I think would be great for them that isn't really that great of an offensive player but can hit a shot and also is just very intelligent defensively. When you have a system where, you know, I think they're going to put the ball in Harden's hands a lot and also just rely on D'Antoni's offensive genius to kind of create looks, I think that Arthur would be great because he'll just really help their defense. They could switch. He's a great communicator, which is something that they really, really struggle with as well. And then, of course, the perpetual rumor, Ryan Anderson, as someone who might get a look here. But again, he might want too many years, and he's certainly not going to help the defense out in the slightest.
And despite Anderson's talent, his timeline really doesn't fit with them, just because it feels like with his injury, sadly enough, that he's kind of a time bomb in terms of his back. And so I think he's a great piece for a team that's looking to get pushed over the top that can take that long-term risk. But it seems almost impossible to me that Anderson is the guy who ends up doing the make good contract this year.
Yeah, that does seem unlikely. I mean, they could sign him to something and think that they could always trade him again. But, you know, I do think that Morey, his mentality, he talks all the time about how only one team can win the championship, how you have to take risks to get there. And although he could be a little bit more on the hot seat now, I mean, we've seen Les Alexander much more involved. We mentioned how D'Antoni doesn't necessarily seem like a Morey hire. But, you know, if he has his druthers, I think he will go for the big fish like we talked about. And then if he doesn't, we'll just get the best guys he can to preserve future flexibility. But you mentioned, you know, the timeline. What is the timeline for this team? I mean, I think they need to get pretty darn good right away with, you know, the clock kind of ticking on Harden. Although he's going to be 27, he'll turn 29 shortly after he becomes a free agent in the summer of 2018. Maybe he's not, I've always thought he's not going to age that well just because he doesn't take the absolute greatest care of his body. So I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to say what their timeline is. It could be we got to be as good as we can these next 2 years, or you just, you know, kind of maintain flexibility even after Harden leaves.
It's a very interesting point. Yeah, as you mentioned, Harden turns 27 this summer, and while it's hard to imagine when he's not focusing that his defense will get much worse, his offense is the entire centerpiece of his value, and it's unusual, but his athleticism is a very important part of that. I mean, it's a different kind of athleticism, but it is still a lot of physical ability, and being a half a step slower, I think, would substantially change how effective that is. And I also think they might officiate him a little bit differently if he's moving a little bit more slowly, so that would be worth watching as well. And what's hard with Houston is just that there are so few other pieces where you go, oh, well, that's another signpost for this team. Their hope has to be that Clint Capella becomes one of those players, but he isn't yet. You don't sit there and go, oh, well, we need to think about Clint Capella when we're developing a timeline for this team. And guys like Ariza and Brewer and Beverly, they're all talented players on reasonable contracts, except for Brewer. But they're not the type of guys that you really care about that. So I think that you can be a little bit flexible about it at this point, but that also makes it hard to develop kind of that theory of the case for free agents unless you say we're building around you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the case is we've got James Harden and we've got some decent enough guys. So just two of you come here. You know, I mean, I think that's like maintaining, if it's only one of them, you know, it's kind of hard to talk yourself into, if you're one of those star free agents, that it's going to be enough. If there's two of you, then maybe you kind of can. And there might be a sentiment to kind of team up now that the Warriors were pretty dominant, although the way they've looked vulnerable in the playoffs is probably in large part, I think, due to Steph Curry returning to mortality, might give people a false sense that they're closer than they are. All right, a couple other things. I think they definitely need a backup point guard. You know, Jason Terry is probably not good enough at that position. Maybe they'll bring him back as like a vet on another minimum deal. But they do have Sergio Yule, who they drafted quite some time ago, a former second-round pick For those who aren't familiar with him, he's been a Spanish national team stalwart. About 6'2", but kind of plays like a combo guard. A pretty good shooter, you know, a feisty defender. He can guard probably most twos. He's not going to be able to switch onto a three, but he could probably guard most twos, can run a little pick and roll. He's just a steady player, not elite in any one particular thing. He's 28 years old. And the information on his buyout is that it was lowered from 5 million euros. We don't know exactly what that is. That's for the website Sportando. We don't have any other information beyond that. On the open market, I think he would probably be like an $8 million a year player when you consider that he's the only one they can negotiate with. You know, 5 to 6 million, maybe that's, and that should be enough. If they give him 3 years, 5 to 6 million a year, that might be enough to make it worth it and pay his buyout and stuff. And it might even take a little bit more than that. And this is kind of the year it's supposed to happen if it's ever going to, because he's 28 right now. He turns 29 in November.
Yeah, and it also makes sense just because there aren't that many other options on the market. And even though James Harden, if you're thinking about somebody who's going to play some of their minutes with him, he takes away some of the responsibilities that a point guard needs because you don't need a primary ball handler. This isn't a great class for those guys either. I mean, there are some that I really like in that role, like Jordan Clarkson and Tyler Johnson. Those guys are functionally not available because their teams are going to match their contracts.
Yeah, Langston Galloway could be another one you might look at. And maybe if they want to just exceed the early bird exception for the Knicks, and the Knicks are trying to use cap space too, maybe they could poach him away. But this doesn't strike me as a team that's going to get into the restricted market, because they're not going to wait until July 9th to free up their money. You know, they can't sign until the end of the moratorium, and they got to wait 3 days. So I think maybe if they just strike out on everything, but I don't see that. I think the Rockets are good enough and need to at least be decent this year. I know the owner was pretty disappointed with how bad they were, that I don't think they can wait around for a restricted free agent. So I wouldn't expect them to be active in that market.
Yeah, one thing I'll make for that also is that there is wiggle room. I've written about this before, and it'll actually be a part of the Sporting News preview that's going up tomorrow, with the guys that are restricted that aren't necessarily worth a max contract because they have a little bit of wiggle room. But the two guys that I think are most prominent in that are probably Evan Fournier and Maurice Harkless, neither of whom I think is a particularly good fit with this Rockets team.
Harkless could be okay. I think they should be playing with a combo forward at the four. But nonetheless, and then a lot of the other problem with sort of these playmaking wings, Fournier being one of them, is your defense now isn't good enough if you've got him next to Harden. Like, that was always the problem when they had Chandler Parsons, right? So you and they have Ariza still, but that guy better be able to play four then. You know, so that's why I like a combo forward better. But again, I don't think they'll be in the restricted market. The usual poo-poo platter on the backup point guard market, DJ Augustin, someone who's more of a shooter type, could be okay for them. Grievous Vasquez, maybe. I think they actually even could use Austin Rivers as just another guy who can create a shot, even if it's an inefficient one. But, not too sexy on the backup point guard market, and we've talked about that ad nauseum, so no need to continue on that.
Yeah, it's a really challenging situation if it boils down to it, which is also part of the reason why I think they really do have a middle ground with Yule.
So they do have a couple of non-guarantees, Beasley and Godlock. Both of those have a guarantee date of August 1st. Godlock, I would not expect them to keep around. Beasley is probably a value contract. He played okay. Another guy who can at least create a shot for them, if not an efficient one. They need that when Harden's out of the game. He's not a good fit when Harden is actually in. And I thought that J.B. Bickerstaff certainly played him a bit too much in the playoffs. But and then the draft picks, they have number 37 and number 43. But you wouldn't expect that any of those guys are going to help them at all this year.
One thing I think we should talk just a little bit more about is just kind of how amazing it is that Terrence Jones and Demo have turned into kind of footnotes that are dependent clauses, depending on, you know, basically what kind of offer sheets they get, as opposed to potential, like, starters or key rotation players, which is what I think we both expected and hoped they would have been at the start of the year.
Yeah, that's a good point. We should talk more about them. I mean, if you were going to have, I would assume that they are not even going to really offer these guys contracts until they kind of go through their free agent business. They could end up just dumping their cap holds. I mean, Demo is someone who I think could be a good player, and maybe even Jones too. Who knows what they think of him after he just had this totally lost year this last year and was like, you know, I don't think he even played like a minute in the playoffs. So I think they'll just sit around and see if those guys get offers, and then for the period that they have to match it, their cap hold stays on the books, and maybe they match it and maybe they don't. I mean, I think those guys are definitely gettable from them, and especially with D'Antoni in the mix now, I think they're going to really want to play with more shooting at the four than those guys can provide. Maybe Demo you keep around if the price for him is kind of commensurate with a backup center and you've struck out on all your other options. But again, if he's going to get an offer sheet, that's got to be at least 2 years under the rules for signing restricted free agents. So now you're busting into 2017 again, and that would better be a tradable contract if you are in fact going to match.
And just because it happened with most notably with the Rockets recently, I do want to mention to people, you said it casually because it is a casual point to us, that when you have a restricted free agent and they sign an offer sheet, when you are the prior team, their cap hold does not get replaced by their salary unless and until you match. So that the most prominent example that recently was actually Chandler Parsons, but then they ended up declining to match it. So with these guys, that is another benefit if they're going to sign for something over it, is that it doesn't impact it until they actually make that decision, which is 3 days after they actually sign.
Yeah, and Cap Dorks will remember that they were kind of waiting on Chris Bosch to decide, and basically the clock was ticking on Bosch to decide as the clock was ticking on that Parsons offer sheet. So Facebook has just debuted a new tool that they wanted to let NBA fans know about, and therefore advertising on this podcast. It is basically a bot, and bots are becoming a lot more prevalent because they're fast, they're easy to use, they're available 24/7. You can do a search for it just right in your Messenger chat window if you search NBA, or if you're using a browser, you can go to nbabot.net, and you can just interact with the bot in a message to get news updates, scores, videos about your favorite teams or players. Like if you wanted to just input Steph Curry, it'll give you the options to see his best highlights, the playoffs, the highlights of his last game. Same thing with J.R. Smith, LeBron James, any of the players in the finals, see highlights from the last game. It's really fast, really easy. It's already in the same window that you're using for your messaging. So you can try it out at nbabot.net. Again, that's nbabot, B-O-T.net, or you can just search NBA in your Facebook Messenger window and just interact with it. It's kind of fun. You can see what's out there from the NBA. All right, let's get some news here, which we haven't in a while. Let's start with Andrew Bogut. Mark Stein reporting that they are basically awaiting MRI results. No structural damage, which is a surprise to me based on how badly he went down when I was sitting in the stands. But then after I actually saw it, that doesn't surprise me too much. It's still, especially because Bogut is not a guy who, you know, is well known for playing through severe injuries. It would surprise me if he returns in the series, but he flew with them to Cleveland and they're kind of trying to interpret the MRI results a little bit more. It's very nebulous that they don't know. I mean, it could even be that they're just fudging on this as a way to like mess with Cleveland and he could actually play. But I mean, the way he got carried off, like it's hard to imagine. He at least was limping around and was able to leave the arena under his own power. But
yeah, I mean, even when Damari Carroll, when we thought his like leg had exploded and he ended up being marginally okay, I from what I remember, he didn't play in the next game of last year's playoffs.
No, he did.
He did.
He played in game two, yeah.
God, that I remember how freaked out we were when that happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's actually the one time that I have like violated my Twitter rule of like getting all depressed about an injury before we know for sure what it is. So anyway, all right. In New York, Kurt Rambis will be remaining on as part of Jeff Hornacek's staff. That's a little weird, as Frank Isola, who you know obviously has no love lost for the Knicks, pointed out. But that sort of indicates that at the very least, you know, Rambis is kind of like a spy for Phil Jackson since they're close. You never necessarily want that dynamic. I mean, I think that's something that in Sacramento with a ton of people on the coaching staff and in the front office with varying agendas and reporting to various people above them about what's going on, you never really care for that dynamic at all. But, that's what's ending up happening. I don't want to say that that's going to be an issue, but it is a little bit curious because it's hard for me to believe that Jeff Hornacek would have been like, oh, yeah, Kurt Rambis, like the guy who finished second for this job that I have no relationship with, really. Yeah, let's keep him on staff.
Yeah, it's definitely strange in that sense, especially when he's still close with the general manager or team president who still has that job. You know, it's not even like he is like a lame duck kind of guy. Hopefully he does.
Well, he can fire him after Phil leaves at the end of the season.
Presumably. But I mean, it is weird for Dorit.
Only if Isaiah Thomas says so. God, I really am channeling Isola right now. This is crazy.
I didn't know you had that in your Twitter. That's fun.
It is very amusing to see the antipathy he has towards the Knicks organization. Let's move on. David Pick, our favorite overseas reporter, reporting that sources close to Boban Marjanovic believe he will re-sign with the San Antonio Spurs. That is not a huge surprise. It is a little bit of a surprise, though, in light of the news that David West is going to opt out of the second year of his basically minimum contract. Now he should do that anyway because he could get 120% raise off of that. But, you know, he's going to kind of evaluate things. I think that was Shams Charania who reported that. And the Spurs, if Duncan and Manu come back, we talked about this in their offseason preview, will basically have to decide who they're going to use their full mid-level exception on. Is it going to be West? Is it going to be Marjanovic? If they're going to match an offer for Marjanovic, that's the most that he could get to begin with. But if Marjanovic just simply re-signs without testing the market, that makes their lives a lot easier. They just can't really pay him that much either unless they dig into an exception.
Yeah, I actually, when I wrote the Houston Rockets preview for the Sporting News, which came out recently, I actually pitched Boban as a not perfect fit for D'Antoni, but as a kind of a Maury-style move because they could elevate the price on him a little bit and heat things up for the Spurs, which who are, of course, a bitter division rival.
For the Sixers, Dario Saric has a July 17th deadline to opt out with Anadolu Efes, the Turkish team that he played for the last 2 years. The report has been that he was always supposed to come over this year. His buyout presumably is not that bad with that being the structure. This is for NBA.com, Brian Colangelo interview. And Saric, we'll see whether he comes over or not. I mean, I think that's kind of the expectation, but he will have to decide before that July 17th whether he's going to come over.
And this is his last year where he has to be tied to the rookie scale. He could be tied to it after, but it is not mandatory after this year.
Danny Ferry has returned to the NBA. He is joining the New Orleans Pelicans in a Jerry West-like consultant role. I don't think he's going to be in New Orleans full-time, but he knows Dell Demps very well from their days together in San Antonio. And I think that Ferry, with some of the things he was able to accomplish in Atlanta, obviously outside of the comments about Luol Deng that got him fired, and also, you know, his dealings with ownership that was detailed in a Windhorst and Arnovitz piece, he embraced the long-term, didn't overpay. I think that is a mentality that has gone lacking for far too long in New Orleans. And so hopefully he will help them. What else we got?
Well, one thing I also want to mention with Atlanta is that they've also done a worse job from a personnel perspective, in my opinion, since he left. You know, like the Tim Hardaway Jr. trade was the second worst trade of last year's draft, with, in my opinion, the Grievous Vasquez one was the worst. But it was, you know, a shocking one in terms of that. Also, just the way that they, you know, got Kirk Heinrich was surprising. And so I think that Ferry looks better because of how well he did and the fact that some of his moves were still paying off. And as you said, the long-term vision, just having his voice in the room for New Orleans as another check on with some of the dysfunction they've had could be a wonderful thing.
A lot of international basketball Olympics news. Giannis, one of the few who is actually in for Greece's qualifying tournament against Italy, having immigrated to Greece. I know he has a lot of affection for his adopted nation, who he's now a citizen for, so maybe I shouldn't say that. But he's in for the qualifying tournament. That is taking place in Turin. Italy and Croatia are the other two nations that are really threats to win that. But Greece, if they can get everybody there, will be probably a big favorite. And they have to win that to make the Olympics. I hope that Greece does win because they would be at least provide somewhat of a threat maybe to Team USA, who is going to have a lot fewer players.
Yeah. Former teammates Russell Westbrook and James Harden are out of the Olympics, and Kings center DeMarcus Cousins is, I believe, the first person who is actually in.
Yeah, he's been told he earned a roster spot. I guess it's not clear that he accepted it yet, per Mark Spears. But, yeah, so it's now, I mean, I don't think that the Team USA is going to lose because, frankly, a lot of these other teams are pretty depleted, number one. And number two, these teams also just aren't as good. Like, Spain is nowhere near as good. Like, they haven't really replaced a lot of the talent that they had, you know, in 08 and 2012. A lot of those guys have just kind of gotten older. So I think that the U.S. is going to win. But if they don't, let's just remember that now, you know, they don't have a ton of their best players. And we'll see whether LeBron goes or not either. You know, he looks like he's going to be playing about as long as he possibly can in an NBA season. We've seen a couple of rumblings now. Steve Kyler from my old pals, Basketball Insiders, and Sean Devaney from your pals, The Sporting News, both reporting that Golden State plans to match any offer for Barnes. We always hear that about any higher profile restricted free agent, and the Players Association actually got the league to crack down on actual on-record public announcements saying they'll match any offer because it was against the spirit of the collective bargaining agreement, was chilling offers for restricted free agents. I don't think that'll be too much of an issue this year with all the cap space around, but now you just hear these kind of leaks instead as a way to kind of, you know, chill the market for your own restricted free agents rather than actual on-record comments.
Yeah, and also another, going back a little bit to international news, one thing that was really interesting was that Nicola Batum, who is an unrestricted free agent this summer, is hopeful for playing in the Olympic qualifier, which will occur during free agency and before he can sign a contract.
Yeah, that's what I get for putting these news items in the outline, like, totally out of order, because we should have done that next. And then, so that might be an indication that he kind of already has a wink-wink deal in place to return to Charlotte. That's certainly what some were speculating. And then nobody's playing for Team Canada.
No one.
Which is kind of, other than Corey Joseph, Tristan Thompson might play. Andrew Wiggins is out, and so they actually had to play in the qualifying tournament as well. That's big good news for France. They're going to be the biggest team as a rival to France. But, yeah, no Andrew Wiggins. Kelly Olynyk had shoulder surgery. He's out. Anthony Bennett, who, believe it or not, actually was okay for them in the tournament of the Americas last year, not even on the roster at all. So, I mean, they're going to have, like, Tyler Ennis. They're going to have Joel Anthony probably will make the team. You know, it's not going to be that strong of a Canadian team, unfortunately.
Star turn for Corey Joseph, calling it now.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Stauskas is out. Jamal Murray is in the draft. Andrew Nicholson is a free agent. Kyle Wilcher is in the draft. Trey Lyles, nobody knows why he's not playing. Robert Sacre apparently won't be on there either. And Andrew Wiggins, no idea why he's not participating. And Dwight Powell is out too. So they have a lot of talent. I would have loved to see full-strength Canada versus full-strength France for a spot in the Olympics, but we unfortunately are not going to see.
And if they hadn't crapped the bed in the Tournament of the Americas, they might have gotten more of those guys to play because it was just the Olympics.
Yeah, and that's, I understand why these guys aren't playing, right? Like, the international basketball financial model is kind of broken right now. Like, if you're in soccer, there are penalties because the international associations and the domestic leagues and all of them are tied together. So but now it's basically just up to the player whether they want to play or not, and they don't really get much compensation for doing it. And especially when you're going to have to not only do one tournament but two, and it's during free agency. Yeah, I totally understand why they're not playing. You know, so if we want to see these tournaments get better, maybe there needs to be a financial incentive. And also, as Mark Cuban has noted a billion times, the Olympics is not something that the NBA gets a part of, and also NBC doesn't have the NBA, so they don't have the incentive to promote the Olympic basketball nearly as much as, you know, blind Paris figure skating or whatever, you know, they really like to do. I guess that's the Winter Olympics. Never mind. I'm sure
your fake Winter Olympics sport was fantastic, though.
I felt like I could have done better, but unfortunately, we are too lazy to re-record that joke. All right, are we done with news?
No,
do we have anything else?
I have one more that I want to mention, because Mo Williams might be the only player with a player option to opt in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, there, I think
the
there,
only
I
one,
think there
huh?
are like 20-something player options, and there are still a few that are open questions, with Aaron Aflalo and Derek Williams probably being the two most interesting, and Alonzo G, I guess, technically. But Mo Williams, it's possible, as this turns out, because Chris Haynes of Cleveland.com is reporting that he will opt in, he could be the only one.
Yeah, J.R. Smith also has to decide by June 16th per our friend Eric Pincus at Basketball Insiders, who we get, thanks again, because we get a lot of the salary information, the basics from him, and obviously we do our own calculations on it to figure out how much space they'll have and stuff, but the raw data that we need comes from him. Smith has an odd situation. He has a player option that he can opt out of by June 16th, but if he opts in, then his salary is only $2.2 million guaranteed, and it's non-guaranteed. The rest of it's non-guaranteed until September 7th. So he, I think, is someone who on the open market can easily get $10 million a year for a couple of years. He's had an excellent season. There's not that much shooting around. He's improved defensively. He's kept his head on straight this year. And while he didn't have much of a market last year and everyone knew he wanted to return to Cleveland, this year I think he will be able to cash in. And I would be shocked if he did not opt out.
Same here.
All right, Dragan Bender, who was someone that I have known about actually since I think he was 15. I first saw him at the 2013 Adidas Eurocamp, and he was part of the first year of what they call their next generation, where they have kind of 14, 15, 16-year-olds playing. That year, I don't think they really played that much. It was more kind of drills and just letting us see guys. But even then, it was clear that, you know, he was super skinny, but very fluid athlete, a guy who likes to get up and down the floor. And then I saw him again in as the youngest guy in the actual Euro camp in 2014, where he wasn't that good. You know, he was shooting the ball a lot, but wasn't able to hit much. And that was right before he then played, and he was still 16 at that point. And then he played in the under-18 European Championships and made the all-tournament team in 2014, despite playing against guys who are a year and 2 years older than him. So he's been known as one of the best prospects in Europe for a while. He unfortunately did not play in the under-19 World Championships last year, in which Croatia actually barely lost to the U.S. in overtime, although it wasn't anywhere close to our best players. You know, we were playing guys who were like 2 years younger than a lot of the players that we're going against. But nonetheless, he didn't play, which is due to a shoe dispute. He has a contract with Adidas, and in what was considered unprecedented at the time, the Croatian Federation, which has a contract with Jordan Brand, tried to force him to wear Jordan Brand, which he couldn't do according to his contract. And so he just had to sit out of the under-19 World Championship. So we didn't really get to see him there going against guys his age. And now he has been at Maccabi Tel Aviv after that. He signed a 6-year deal with them, but he has a manageable buyout. I think it's $1.3 million, as we talked about a little bit ago. And so he didn't play for them, the big team at all. He played for the junior team last year. And now he played all this year at 18. He's still 18. And he played in the Israelis League against men and actually did pretty well.
Yeah, he did. And it is kind of amazing that despite like your long history and numerous other people who are draft aficionados, especially European ones with him, he is the youngest player in this draft.
Yeah, he is really young. His birthday is...
It's November.
Yeah, November. That's right. So he's basically, only a month older than Giannis was when he went into the draft. So he's basically the age of like probably a lot of guys who are, in the 2017 high school class. And the reason I gave you guys all this history is because we've never really seen him playing against guys his own age. And the reason that's interesting is because he has great measurables. He's 7'1", weighs about 225 right now, has a 9'3 standing reach, 7'2 wingspan, very fluid athlete, as I mentioned, kind of a stretch four, but can grab and go, at least at the lower levels he has. He was instructed basically not to do that when he was playing for Maccabi. He was kind of just stationed out in the perimeter and told not to screw up, although you'd see some flashes from him. So he only had a 16% usage rate for Maccabi. I mean, the fact that he was getting minutes for, in a league against other men, he didn't play much in the EuroLeague. Maccabi had a very disappointing year in the EuroLeague. He was mostly playing in the Israeli domestic league, which has some pretty good teams, but also, is pretty bad at, and some of the translations of it show it as kind of being about the same as like the Pac-12 overall as far as how people translate to the NBA. Although I think it's obviously the style of play is much different and people are a lot smarter and stronger in the Israeli league.
Well, and one of the ways of illustrating how kind of it can be a problem with finding stuff for Bender is I was trying to figure out a way to say like, okay, how good a free throw shooter is he? And so there just aren't enough stats on him at this point to get it in a reliable number, just because everything's been so spread out and so sporadic.
Yeah, I think he mostly spotted up for threes, and he shot a very encouraging 37%, and that's from the FIBA line. It's 22 feet, so this isn't the college line that we're talking about now. And he's improved his release. He has improved his form. He has a high release. It's pretty quick. He shot more than half of his shots from three-point range, but shooting 37% is actually quite excellent. He was not really asked to play make much, especially when he was playing with their frontline guys. But you see flashes, even going back to that tournament, that was really to see him with some freedom with the ball in his hands. Like, that's where I had to go back to watch him as a 16-year-old from 2 years ago to watch that film. But his passing is fantastic for his size. His feel for the game is fantastic. He's always looking for an opportunity to move or cut. He plays with pretty good effort, and he wouldn't get discouraged either. Even though he was never touching the ball really for Maccabi unless he had a wide open three, he was always trying to move, always trying to find something, even though he wasn't a major part of the offense. And I think that the experience of, while he didn't get a chance to really spread his wings offensively that much, there are other benefits to the fact that he had to really earn his minutes, you know, playing against men with competition from other men on his team, because he realized that he couldn't screw up and he had to play hard, you know. And I think that of all the guys that I've looked at so far, he kind of has the best feel on defense, makes the fewest mistakes, you know, the fewest times of just like kind of not hustling or taking it easy, you know, because he knew he was just going to get pulled out and he had to play hard. And so I think while he is pretty skinny still and scoring may be a problem for him and finishing inside may be a problem from a physical standpoint, I think that mentally he could actually be a little bit more ready than a lot of people give him credit for, because he's going to play hard and he's got good feel and he's not going to screw up, which is, you know, obviously what kills people about rookies.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And what I find really interesting about Bender's game is that a lot of his weaknesses can be defined by a single kind of phrase, which is that he's not a center. And so, like, he's not a great, I don't love him as a, you know, as a rim protector or as a post defender. But if the rule with that is always kind of, if you can't play center, then what if you can play the four? And I think he can play the four well enough to survive, more than well enough to survive.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, one of the big appeals too is that Kevin Pelton and some of the other Stifel's translations, I've seen, rate him very highly. I think he is in the top three among the statistical translations in all the ones that I've seen. And a lot of that is because he had a 6% block rate, pretty decent shot blocker, and he also just defensively has pretty quick feet for his size. You know, he's okay switching out, and at 7-1, you know, that's pretty ridiculous. You know, if you compare, he's going to get a lot of Porzingis comparisons, not even remotely the same type of players at all. Bender is much quicker, much smoother. Porzingis is probably a better leaper, has more length. You know, Bender's not going to dunk on you the way Porzingis will on occasion. Bender's probably not the shooter that Porzingis is, although Bender is, you know, remember, a year younger than Porzingis was coming into the draft, and he's was shooting a pretty darn good percentage from three now. So that's kind of the big appeal, is that Bender is going to have this versatility defensively to kind of guard one through five eventually. You kind of hope that that's true. Mike Schmitz made a big deal of that in his scouting video of him, which obviously for all these prospects, I recommend you look at Mike's videos. But I wasn't quite as enamored of Bender's defense against guards in isolation as Mike was. I mean, I think, you know, he's, for his size, for his age, he moves pretty well, but he wasn't, like, you know, locking guys down, really making them uncomfortable. Like, they're able to kind of score on him, but, you know, he wasn't getting blown by. He was making guys hit tough shots. So I think it is something that is going to play, but I wasn't, like, so unbelievably wowed by that, maybe quite the way that Mike was.
I agree with you on that. And another point is that of course his body will improve with time, but the level of play, especially if you're thinking of Bender as a starter, between the guards that he was defending in a lot of that material and sure, who he will be defending in the NBA, even if you want to think about somebody like Derrick Rose, you know, like Derrick Rose is very different from the guys that you can see around the world. And he's, you know, I would say he's probably a below average point guard, at the starting point guard at this point. And so you think about, you know, of course, the Russell Westbrooks of the world. But with Bender, what I find interesting about the idea of switching, like, kind of like 1-5 with him, is the idea of him being a useful cog in the defense, but not being the best player. And something we've talked about a lot during these playoffs, and for whatever reason, the guy I'm thinking of with this is Harrison Barnes, is that there is an intense value to not being the weak link.
Yeah, that's a good point. And when you consider his block percentage, pretty decent steal percentage for his size as well. He's a smart player. He hasn't really mastered like verticality and help defense yet. And a lot of times too, you know, he's playing against guys who are, you know, in a four out system, who, you know, he's guarding out at the 3-point line. And then when he did try to defend, so he's not really mastered verticality yet. The strength obviously is a problem defending the post. Like in one of the games I watched, he basically got three fouls trying to guard someone in the post, like on one possession, which was pretty ugly. But he does compete hard. He has gotten stronger, you know, since he was 16, as you would expect. And he's gotten more athletic as well. You know, he used to not be able to jump off at 2 feet at all. Now he can a little bit. But the biggest limitation for him to me is just, I don't know that he's going to be a guy who's ever going to create his own offense one-on-one. And that's kind of an issue when you're drafting someone, you're talking about him being considered at the number three pick. You know, I think he can be a pick-and-pop guy, but is he going to be good enough to prevent the other team from just switching on him? You know, is he going to be able to punish guys in the post? I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. Now, he is incredibly young, so he could get much better at that, but You know, he doesn't really have a ton of explosion, doesn't finish well when he has a body on him, and maybe he can get better at that, but he's definitely much more of kind of a one-foot jumper than he is a two-foot jumper, and doesn't play with a ton of force out there overall, which you would expect for an 18-year-old playing in against, you know, 25-year-olds.
The analogy I would make to kind of what I think his eventual pick-and-roll possibility could be is something like what Draymond Green does, and I mean that in a very particular way, and that is that as good a player as Draymond Green is, when he gets that 4-on-3 that everybody talks about, it very rarely ends up with him scoring in the interior. That's just not what usually turns out. Sometimes he shoots a mid-ranger. More often than that, he passes based on whatever opening is created. Often that's a lob to the center. I think that's what Bender is going to eventually do, is that he will be a player who can take advantage of that. It just will not be finishing at the rim unless he gets a whole heck of a lot better there.
Yeah, and that's, again, why you have to hope that he's not switchable, because if you can just switch that, it takes a lot of that away. I do trust him to play make a lot. I mean, he throws some great outlet passes, full court passes. He'll throw hook passes off the dribble. He was doing that when he was 16 to shooters on the weak side. Ran a little pick and roll even, and threaded a nice bounce pass. I mean, the type of passing that he does at his size. Now, he doesn't have any moves. That's the biggest problem for him, too, is that, you know, he's not going to blow by you off the dribble. He can grab and go, but he's just going to kind of go in a straight line. And if you don't get in front of him, he'll go in for a layup. But, you know, he's not going to, like, Euro step around guys. Like, that's something he really has to work on. You know, we don't see him have the feel for just faking guys out. But, you know, throughout most of his career, he hasn't had the freedom to really try that kind of stuff either. You know, in the post, he's got, like, a hook shot that he's broken out with both hands, but it doesn't really look good. Hasn't been effective trying to post up at all. And trying to attack on closeouts off the dribble, his footwork isn't great. He doesn't cover a lot of ground with his long strides. He sort of, you know, takes a couple of steps to really get going, and wasn't really able to blow by guys much at all, even when he would sort of have a little bit of an advantage. But, you know, he shot this 37% on threes. One problem there, though, is that when he makes it, it looks great, but he has a lot of really bad misses, and he can be pretty inconsistent. His form looks better, and maybe as he's trying to learn that new form, that's why he misses so much. But I've got a little way to go before I'm going to say, all right, this guy's going to shoot 37% on three-pointers in his career in the NBA, you know, off of pick and pops and stuff, which he did a little bit of, but I still need to see more there.
Yeah, something I've deliberately waited a long time to bring up is that there was this thing, especially when people listened to when we talked about Brandon Ingram, and we were very critical at certain moments about Brandon Ingram. And I think we're giving more praise on Dragan Bender, despite I think that, you know, they're somewhat similar players in terms of what I think their eventual roles could be, and they're going to be drafted at very similar spots. And I think part of the reason for that is also the idea of expectations. Like, nobody is talking about Dragan Bender as being a possibility for the number one pick, and people are with Ingram. But I mean, to me, I think that they're relatively close as prospects.
Yeah, Ingram is just more dynamic with the ball in his hands, running pick and roll. He's obviously doesn't have that 7-1 length. You know, I think Bender is going to be much better on defense than Ingram. And Bender can legitimately play the 4, maybe even play a little bit of 5 as he fills out some. But Ingram is just, I mean, is not that great of a finisher, but he's way better than Bender is. You know, Bender is just a really bad finisher. If he has any kind of a body on him at all, it's just, you know, he's not even going to be close with it. He does shoot pretty decently on free throws, 73%. So I think that's a good indication, but that's only 22 out of 30 on the whole year. He wasn't getting fouled a lot either. So he and Ingram's roles are just so incredibly different with what they're asked to do for their teams and the personnel around them that it's hard to make a judgment. But, you know, I mean, I would probably lean towards Ingram being a little bit better of a prospect than Bender, because I do think Ingram will be able to score to some degree and create his own shot. I don't see and Bender, I think, you know, he can be maybe perpetually an underrated player in the NBA because his scoring will probably be his worst attribute, especially his one-on-one scoring, and that's still the thing that people look to the most, creating for yourself and others. But if I'm drafting someone in the top 5, I want someone with, like, superstar upside. I don't think that Bender has superstar upside because he's just not going to be a good enough scorer. I think he can be a very, very good player in the NBA, but I don't think he can become a superstar.
Right, I agree with you on just about all that, and I think that that does provide a little bit of thing about that we do like Ingram quite a bit. It's just that he's a little bit different than Simmons. But
yeah, I don't think Ingram is necessarily going to become a superstar either, but you can at least construct a way in which he could become a superstar, and I don't think he can.
And the other nuance that will be really interesting in terms of how we go into the draft is that I think there are a lot of teams that can use either one of those guys for what they are. Like, I've been shipping, I wrote about it today a little bit, especially after I watched more footage of Bender, that I would really love him on the Timberwolves. I think that there's a lot of offensive and defensive fits there that would make them really compelling. And, you know, those things would still be true of Ingram. He's just going second.
Yeah, so the major questions for how he's going to develop, you know, number one, is he going to be able to score? Number two, is his shooting for real? You know, can he be a pick-and-pop guy? And then, you know, is he going to be able to make him pay for switching? He might, you know, he's got the passing ability to maybe run a pick-and-roll, but, you know, is he going to be able to actually, like, beat a center off the dribble if you just switch a 4 or 5 pick-and-roll? Like, probably not, I'm guessing. And then, you know, how much more athletic can he get to is another question. And can he really be a guy who can finish with some force around the rim or not? I'm not sure. I mean, I think he's, someone who could get a lot more athletic. I think he's got really good feel and he's got size and he plays hard. So it's going to be hard for him to just be nothing in the NBA. But, you know, is he going to be a guy who can really be a game-changing defensive force at the four? You know, I'm not quite sure about that. He's got a decent chance, but, you know, he's not someone that I'm looking at. It's like, all right, this is for sure going to happen.
No, I like him best from what I've seen so far. I like him best as kind of like the fourth or fifth, eventually, as the fourth or fifth best starter on a very good team. But that is incredibly valuable. You know, those type of players are important to have, and he does it at a role with strengths that are unusual for somebody who kind of has that kind of framework in place. And I think he has the physical ability to go beyond that. I think that it's crazy for me to have a guy who's the youngest player in the draft who I actually think, for the top end of this draft in particular, he has a higher floor than some guys.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just that he's so weak right now, too. I mean, you could look at it that way. And, you know, he struggled with the athleticism in the Israeli league. You know, he's going to struggle a little bit with athleticism in the NBA. So, you know, you could say mentally, I think he's going to be closer to ready. But physically, you know, he's got a long way to go. And I think just from a confidence standpoint, too, that he just hasn't really been able to play in such a way that he's really spreading his wings and kind of pushing his boundaries the way a lot of American guys get to do playing against people their own age. You know, that's how you get to the point where, like, he doesn't really have any moves because he just, you know, hasn't had a chance to kind of be unafraid to screw up and really push the boundaries for himself. So that's something that I think kind of afflicts a few European prospects who kind of play up this way a lot. All right, I think that's good on that. You got anything to plug before we go?
Yeah, so my Game 5 material went out on The Athletic, and also my off-season preview for the Orlando Magic will be going up on Wednesday morning at the Sporting News.
All right, and Houston's going up soon, too,
Houston,
right?
Went up on Monday.
All right, so that'll be a nice companion to everything we talked about today. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. I will be back to live tweeting on Thursday for Game 6 of the finals. And then thanks to everyone who's giving us a review on iTunes or even a rating, which doesn't take very long. We appreciate that. Helping new people discover the show, or just tell your friends about us. That's probably actually even better than giving us a review or a rating. So we really appreciate all the support. We will be back tomorrow night. Till then.